Today I hope to address how antibacterial products, especially those made with triclosan, are both misbranded and adulterated. Misbranded in that they don't do what they claim that they do, and adulterated in that they actually cause harm. This presentation will focus on how the soap and detergent industry, as well as the cosmetics industries, prey on consumer misinformation and germophobia. So one thing to know before we start off is that triclosan is a pesticide. Triclosan was originally created back in the 1960s as an antibacterial surgical scrub. These formulations were used by hospital staff who washed their hands longer than the average consumer, and the concentrations in these products were also higher than those we see in our usual consumer products today. Now triclosan is in thousands of products. It lines the shelves of our local grocery stores, our medicine cabinets, our cupboards, and in our bodies. We'll find it every day. So for those of you that are already keeping an eye to avoid antibacterial soaps, kudos. Also, be aware that triclosan goes under the trade name Microban. This is where you'll find our triclosan in products like textiles, fabrics, plastics, footwear, home appliances like washers and dryers, and the dog and cat bowls that look like the gallon jugs of water. So to quantify how ubiquitous these products are, I want to give you two figures. First, U.S. consumers spend an estimated $1 billion per year on antibacterial soaps. Second, 75% of all liquid and bar soaps on the market contain triclosan or triclocarban. Triclocarban is the sort of chemical cousin to triclosan. So what this industry would prefer to keep under wraps are the numerous public health impacts associated with this pesticide. First, triclosan accumulates in the human body. So we'll find triclosan in blood, urine, breast milk, and umbilical cord blood. Again, to quantify the seriousness of this problem, the 2003-2004 CDC NHANES survey found triclosan in 3/4 of the U.S. population. And the current CDC estimate is that human triclosan levels have increased over 41% just in 2 years, between 2004 and 2006. Triclosan is also linked to antibiotic resistance. In the lab, scientists have found the potential for cross-resistance or co-resistance to other antimicrobials. And of course, antibiotic resistance is a major problem facing public health professionals today. The body of science demonstrating triclosan's ability to disrupt normal thyroid functioning is well documented. Animal studies, in particular rat studies, have shown that triclosan can disrupt thyroid hormones, normal cell functioning, and cellular development. We've also seen studies on triclosan and the American bullfrog and how triclosan has been able to disrupt the thyroid hormone-associated gene expression. This I'll use as my excuse for not having my slides in on November 3rd. On November 4th, a new study was published out of the University of Florida linking triclosan to an interference with pregnancy hormones. So scientists found that triclosan has the ability to interfere with an enzyme necessary to metabolize estrogen. The enzyme is known as estrogen sulfotransferase, and it works to metabolize estrogen and also helps estrogen pass through the placenta to reach the growing baby. Estrogen is vital for the developing baby and in the growth of brain cells and development of genes. In this study, they found that triclosan may also reduce blood flow to the baby. Since triclosan interrupts estrogen, reduced estrogen can ultimately constrict the uterine artery, reducing vital blood flow to the baby. So now I'd like to highlight some of the numerous environmental concerns associated with triclosan. Triclosan is not completely removed from the wastewater treatment process. The best estimate is that wastewater treatment removes 90 to 98% of the triclosan flushed down the drain. But when we're talking about a pesticide that's used in the hundreds of tons annually, 2 to 10% is quite a substantial amount. So much so that the U.S. Geological Survey has identified triclosan as one of the most frequently detected contaminants in U.S. streams and waterways. When triclosan is released back into the environment and exposed to sunlight, it produces toxic degradates and transformation products. Specifically, DCP is a potential endocrine disruptor identified by the EPA. Other degradates include 2,4-6-triclophenol and 2,4-6-TCP, a known carcinogen and endocrine disruptor. Some studies have also shown that triclosan, when exposed to sunlight, can produce small amounts of chloroform gas. As we know, chloroform is a carcinogen. And triclosan also breaks down into methyltriclosan in the presence of sunlight. And methyltriclosan is actually more persistent than triclosan and is also bioaccumulative. In papers published in 2003 and 2009, scientists discovered that triclosan, when exposed to sunlight, generated a specific suite of four different dioxin. They're listed on this slide as 2,8-dichlorobenzo-p-dioxin, 2,3,7-triclodibenzo-p-dioxin, 1,2,3-trichlorobenzene-p-peroxide-dioxin. I shouldn't have decided to read the list. Apologies. The bottom line is that dioxin are a family of chemicals linked to cancer, weakened immune systems, and reproductive problems. They're also highly persistent organic pollutants that bioaccumulate. They can be highly carcinogenic and cause problems such as weakening of the immune system, decreased fertility, altered sex hormones, miscarriage, birth defects, and cancer. This particular study identified these dioxins in Lake Pepin. Lake Pepin is at the head of the Mississippi River, which travels through approximately 12 or 13 states. These four dioxin, according to scientist Bill Arnold, come only from triclosan, and they didn't exist in Lake Pepin before triclosan was introduced. In most current sediments, triclosan-derived dioxin accounted for about 30% of the total dioxin mass. So water testing by the U.S. Geological Survey has identified triclosan as one of the top 10 most persistent contaminants in U.S. rivers, streams, and waterways. This, of course, is very bad news for all aquatic life. So triclosan has been found to accumulate in fish, earthworms, and more recently, in 2009, a study identified triclosan in wild-caught dolphins. That study is particularly important because it was the first to identify triclosan in wild marine life. Triclosan is particularly toxic to aquatic life, including algae, phytoplankton, and the Daphnia magna, which is a water flea. But many of these organisms are the backbone for our aquatic ecosystem. So I go to the store, I buy an antibacterial hand soap, I wash my hands with it, it goes down the drain, only about 8% of it is potentially 2 to 8% of it is removed, the rest, or sorry, 90 to 98% is removed. The 2 to 8% persists in finished water, finished wastewater, or sludge. The USDA has said that triclosan remains in biosolids and degrades only at low levels. In 2009, EPA found triclosan in 94% of sewage sludge samples taken from publicly owned treatment works across the US. Overall, high concentrations of antimicrobials were found in this study. And triclosan was the second highest contaminant, only to its chemical cousin, triclocarban. So because triclosan contaminated sludge is applied to agricultural fields, there are real concerns about the potential to affect our food system. A recent study from the University of Toledo titled, "The Uptake of Pharmaceutical and Personal Care Products by Soybean Plants from soils applied with biosolids and irrigated with contaminated water found that triclosan and triclocarban were readily taken up by the roots and translocated to other parts of the plant, including the soybean. So although this study was done in the lab, we can understand what the real-life implications are if this happens in actual fields that grow crops that are fed to our animals or potentially crops that we might consume ourselves. So all of this might sound a lot like other chemicals that us activists are already concerned about, things like BPA or parabens, things that are known as, you know, surfactants or plasticizers, things that, although they are toxic and we want them out, serve a purpose in their products as either surfactants and plasticizers. Well, the difference here is that triclosan actually serves no purpose at all. In 2005, an FDA advisory panel of experts voted 11-1 that triclosan, that antibacterial soaps were no more effective than regular soap and water in fighting infections. The AMA, the American Medical Association, has said over the past decade that no data exists to support the efficacy of these products being antibacterial products. The only product for which there is efficacy data is from Colgate, and it's for their Colgate Total toothpaste. And of course, this is provided by the industry, this efficacy data. But at this time, FDA has no evidence that triclosan added to antibacterial soaps and body washes provide extra health benefits over soap and water. And that's directly from their website. So, signs that the tides are turning. The first ever lawsuit against to challenge these false efficacy claims against antibacterial products comes from the state of Illinois. They filed a class action lawsuit that states DioCorp's claims are deceptive and misleading. They're designed solely to cause consumers to buy the product. DioComplete contains triclosan. The suit wants Dio Corporation enjoined from continuing its deceptive advertising, disgorgement and damages for consumer fraud, and deceptive business practices. So where triclosan is used as a bactericide, a fungicide, or an odor resistor, it's regulated by the EPA under FIFRA. And so both the EPA and the FDA have some responsibility for regulating this product. Unfortunately, neither of them care to restrict the product, these products. Consumer uses like the ones that we've already talked about, hand soaps, toothpaste, and other prominent personal care products are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration under FFDCA. Yet a 2005 advisory panel to the FDA concluded that triclosan posed an unacceptable health risk. However, FDA still ignores this warning. So if it's not EPA's problem and it's not FDA's problem, then whose problem is it? Unfortunately, the burden falls on the consumer. And that's where 2 years ago, Food and Water Watch embarked on a campaign alongside Beyond Pesticides to ban triclosan. Our long-term goals fit into our organization to address the water pollution from toxic chemicals. My immediate task was to work with Beyond Pesticides to ban all the medical uses of triclosan in the form of various petitions. And our short-term goal was to identify House and Senate targets for legislation. In general, we want to, as a part of this campaign, we've wanted to generate public awareness. We've wanted to urge the agencies to restrict the use of triclosan and cancel all non-medical registrations of triclosan. So in the 2 years since I've been a part of Food and Water Watch, we've petitioned both FDA and EPA, FDA in 2009 and EPA in 2010. The result of our petitions was interest from members of Congress in this issue, and specifically Congressman Ed Markey, sent letters to EPA and FDA asking what the status of the regulation for triclosan was. Our petitions then launched an FDA year-long investigation, which is ongoing. We hope to see the results of their investigation in April 2011. Our work in Highland Park, New Jersey, led to a phase-out of the municipal purchase of triclosan, and we're working on similar resolutions in Middlesex County, New Jersey, New Paltz, New York, San Francisco, and we're also hoping to see statewide legislation in Minnesota. Over 10,000 of our activists have written to Congress calling for a ban on the non-medical uses of triclosan. Another sign that there's progress here is the dates for this range between 2009 and 2010, that the European Union passed regulations limiting the amount of triclosan allowed in cosmetics. SIBA, the major manufacturer of triclosan, voluntarily canceled its U.S. registrations for the technical grade triclosan incorporated into plastics and textiles. The European Commission announced that triclosan has been formally withdrawn from the European list to use as a food contact additive, so that's where triclosan might be used in a cutting board or your lunch sacks that you take with you in the mornings. And most recently, the Natural Resources Defense Council filed a lawsuit against the FDA for failing to issue a final rule regulating triclosan. The rule that regulates triclosan under FDA, that's not FIFRA, it's just it's called a monograph, is over 32 years old, has not been touched since 1996, and if it were completed today, would not allow triclosan in any of these over-the-counter personal care products. So kudos to them for pushing EPA and FDA as well. So our ongoing efforts are to collaborate with the scientific and medical communities, to continue working with environmental and public health institutions, continue to elevate the involvement of water treatment utilities, which we're actively engaged in, and continue to build a strong coalition of safer cosmetics and consumer protection groups across the country. So what you guys can do is to help educate others about the dangers associated with triclosan, encourage the use of plain soap and water, urge the FDA and EPA to ban the non-medical uses of triclosan, propose resolutions in your local towns, counties, state to ban the use of triclosan in municipal and state buildings, and work with school districts and parent organizations to restrict the use of this pesticide. I'd like to thank Nichelle Harriet from Beyond Pesticides and Rolf Halden from Arizona State University for providing data and some slides. And if you'd like to learn more about triclosan or our broader work at Food and Water Watch, please visit our website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 10 minutes now for questions and comments. Yes.
So this is a comment to Martin Donahue, and he talked about fines and imprisonment. So overall, in the pharmaceutical industry that I know the best, so recently there was the $2.3 billion fine against Pfizer. Same time, the products of Pfizer was that fine was levied around. Pfizer had made over 16 billion dollars of products, so that's a ratio of 7-1. And when you talk about imprisonment, back in the early 80s, there was a book that came out called Corporate Crime in the Pharmaceutical Industry. The author had gone around and interviewed senior executives in a number of companies and found out that they already thought about jail time because they had, at least two corporations had positions that were called more or less vice president in charge of going to jail. So I have nothing against throwing these people in prison or fining them, but I think that those tactics still aren't going to be enough. Even large fines, in the range of billions of dollars are not going to discourage companies, and I think we need to be thinking about other more creative ways of dealing with them. I mean, stopping them from doing bad things is obviously the first thing, but if they've done bad things, there have to be more creative ways of dealing with them at that level.
Do you want to comment?
That was well said, I agree.
Yes. Does anyone have a comment?
I'll try to make this brief. I don't know a whole lot about the issue of electronic medical records. I have talked with some people from institutions who have adopted certain electronic medical records who are not very happy with them. My personal experience with this, and I'll try to keep this story very short, is there was an agreement inked between General Electric Medical Systems and Columbia New York Presbyterian Hospital recently that basically was a 10-year technology transfer agreement so that Columbia New York Presbyterian, which is one of the largest academic medicine conglomerates in the United States, would buy only GE products, and that included electronic medical records as well as x-ray equipment, CAT scanners, radiation therapy equipment. And there was an article in New England Journal that discussed the economic consequences of such a merger, including with respect to privacy issues and who would own the data on the electronic medical records when that agreement expired and so on. My problem with that article, and this is somewhat self-serving and it leads to one of the cases that I was going to discuss, is that the irony, which was not discussed in the article, was that GE is the largest corporate polluter in the United States and wrecked 200 miles of the Hudson River by dumping PCBs over there in there over two decades. And the irony that seemed to be lost on the New England Journal's authors was that the Hudson River flows right past Manhattan, of course. And those patients who got their cancer from exposure to PCBs from General Electric's water in the Hudson were then going to be going to these hospitals to get CT scanned with GE equipment, and their cancers treated with GE radiation therapy equipment, which is the perfect cradle to give healthcare concept where GE is allowed to wrap this all into one. So, and there are other companies that are also involved in the EMR thing, but I don't want to take up time from other questions.
Yes. Kathy, do you want to?
It's really challenging and very overwhelming at times. My best advice for what to purchase is the Environmental Working Group has a database called the Skin Deep Database. What you can or not tolerate until the larger system changes.
The person in the black top there.
Yeah.
Preemption is a sort of a typical strategy that's been used all around the world, and corporations tend to venue shop as a delaying tactic, and to delay as long as possible having to reveal anything, and then try to settle, as talked about. What was the rest of your
question? Well, I actually was hoping you'd educate the group more than really answer a question for me. I'm a lawyer, and I just want everyone who's an advocate at the local and state level to know that that's another tactic they're using. It just preempts your ability to do any kind of public health regulation. And so you should be really aware that this is going on. So when language is put into bills and policies that preempts your ability to work with people at the level, you know that that's happening. So, like Nashville has many labeling laws, and then the state preempted the ability of the health department to actually pass the labeling laws. But these things are happening all over the country, and it's really important to get to know. That's really all I wanted to get.
And globally, it's true as well with the trade agreements, like NAFTA, where through the government, the corporations really push and sue for regulations. We've seen it happen time and time again, California and air quality standards and automobiles and lots of places where it's happened. So they do it that way as well.
Yes. Yeah.
I was just told that to add on to this analysis, that in terms of framing, it's not just to think of this as corporations or corruption, but a larger question about capitalism as a social order. Because I think that's where this is coming from. And I think the first gentleman's question about what can be done legally through this is different than a different type of political struggle against these, I don't want to say against these corporations, but against capital and the flows of capital around the world, its attempts to cheat in labor. It's just a piece of a system of endless growth. And that part of that analysis of the nature of capital as a system, I think, needs to be studied along with the particularities of corporations and the corruption. I think I would say capitalism itself is organized crime in a certain way. So,
yes.
Can I just make a comment?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I totally agree, and I think that there are other alternative forms of economic policy and democracy. Probably one of the ones I like the most is Paracon or participatory economics, and Michael Albert's the one who's written the most about that. I'll save my comment for the attorney, but if the attorney could please come up and talk to me afterward, I'd appreciate it.
Just made a comment and advertised your organization, but it really goes to one of my comments about how those of us in public health who recognize this is an issue, we do need to be collaborating, pulling together all the organizations like yours, and really joining in a single focus, in my perspective, to do something about this. I'm glad you're here. I saw your booth as well.
Again, really quickly, this kind of information is woefully undercovered in the curricula of medical and nursing schools, for instance, and even in public health schools. I can tell you, it's a quick personal experience. I was on a panel with the Association of Schools of Public Health to come up with 25 objectives for what all undergrads should know about public health, regardless of their major. And one of the things that I wanted to include was the precautionary principle. And on the phone conferences, which included deans of public health schools and department chairs, a substantial proportion of people said that they did not know what the precautionary principle was, and asked me to write a summary on this. So it's at the highest levels, people aren't aware of some of the basic environmental and public health tenets.
If I could add to that, we also have a prejudice within public health against this approach. I proposed a course on this to a school of public health program, and they turned it down because it was not balanced.
Martha?
Hi, I'm Martha Lipkin.
Could you also tell us where the business meeting is going to be tonight? And perhaps I was going to put in a plug for that. Or if you want to wait a minute to find it, why don't we take one last question and then I'll...
It's in this building,
407. Okay, so 407, I was going to encourage you to come if you'd like to participate. And one last question.
Time.
Yeah, just do this one and then...
Triclosan has registrations for use in a surgical scrub that, again, are in higher concentrations than what we find on the consumer market. There's also patents out on thousands of medical devices, catheters, a lot of things. And we don't know, I don't know the percentage of which those products are used in the medical setting. I just know that there are the patents for them.
And thank you to the Socialist Caucus for sponsoring this session and other important sessions.